due to inflation. Lourdes Garcia Navarro, NPR News, Jerusalem.
Britain and France are pooling their defenses in a bid to cut costs while still maintaining a military edge in Europe. They're establishing a joint brigade-sized army contingent with air and sea support. It can take part in NATO, European Union, and UN operations. The unprecedented partnership comes at a time when countries are looking to tighten their budgets during a slow global recovery. Here's the latest from Wall Street. We're seeing gains. Dow's up 68 at 11,192. NASDAQ up 20 points at last check at 25.25. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from U.S. Oncology, united with 1,300 oncologists nationwide to help patients fight cancer. Online at usoncology.com.
Programs on WILL are made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
With over 100 films to his credit, Michael Caine knows a thing or two about acting, like how to look like you aren't.
If you're watching me give a performance and you turn to your companion and you say, isn't that Michael Caine a wonderful actor? Then I've failed.
On the next Fresh Air, Michael Caine talks about his life and work. He has a new memoir. Join us.
Today at 1 p.m. only on AM 580.
Good morning. This is Focus, our morning talk show. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you listening. Harriet Williamson is our producer. Kyle Mabry is at the controls. We're sorry that we're not able to do the show that we had scheduled for this hour. We were going to talk with Dr. John Wang. He's a neurosurgeon at Carl Foundation Hospital, and we were going to talk about stroke. And he was called in this morning to do emergency surgery. So we, as I said in the beginning, we wish him well and the person that he is taking care of. And we think we can do that on another day. I think there's some good information there we'd like to bring to you, but we'll not do that today. So we're going to the Focus Archives for something on a very different subject. Hope you will enjoy listening to the show. As you listen, do keep in mind that for this hour, we'll not take your calls. In the late 1880s, Frank Lenz had a dream. He wanted to ride a bicycle around the world. He was somebody who was already well known for racing and riding long distances on the high wheel cycles of the time. And I'm sure that you've probably seen pictures of people riding this type of bicycle. It's the kind that has the giant front wheel, really tiny back wheel, where the rider sits up quite high. He decided, however, for his world tour that he would attempt to do something that hadn't been done before. He was riding what was called a safety bicycle, and this is something really is the forerunner of today's road bike. You'd look at it and recognize it as a bicycle. He set out on this journey from his home in Pittsburgh. He rode west across the United States, and then took a ship, went to Hawaii, Japan, China, rode across India, and after 2 years and some 15,000 miles, he vanished in eastern Turkey. People were following his trip, and so his disappearance made headlines across this country and also really contributed to a kind of international diplomatic incident. It certainly contributed to growing tensions between Turkey and the West. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking with cycling historian David Herlihy. He tells the story of Frank Lenz in a newly published book that's titled The Lost Cyclist. It is published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt Company. David Herlihy is author of Bicycle, A History, that won the 2004 Award for Excellence in the History of Science and is a leading authority on the history of the bicycle, has done a lot of interviews on that subject, and we're very pleased that he could spend some time with us this morning to tell the story. And Mr. Herlihy, hello.
Hello.
Hey, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh. My pleasure, David.
It's just really, it's an amazing story when you you think about just how physically challenging this would have been, how he would have been going through places where they certainly wouldn't have seen a lot of Westerners and maybe had never seen a bicycle. The idea that he decided to do this all by himself. He was only 25 years old. Tell us some more about Frank Lenz.
Well, he was a German-American. His parents were both born in Germany, and they emigrated to the U.S. just after the close of our Civil War. And Frank was born 2 years later in Philadelphia. His biological father, Adam, was a cigar maker. His mom, I assume, was a homemaker. Adam seems to have disappeared when Frank was a toddler. It's not clear whether he was killed. Unfortunately, death records are spotty going back that far, so we don't really know what happened to his dad, but we do know that his mom took him to Pittsburgh and remarried there when Frank was about six. She remarried a William A. Lenz, so Frank Reinhardt became Frank Lenz and grew up in Pittsburgh in a very modest home. But he was a bright child, and he did well at school, and he learned accounting and exquisite penmanship and landed a pretty good job in Pittsburgh Strip District, working at a brass manufacturing company. And so that earned him something like $1,000 a year, and that was enough to spend about $125 on one of these high wheelers you described. Of course, that was the only kind of bicycle at the time, and Frank loved it. I mean, he spent every free moment on top of that, going into the countryside and with his friends or on his own. Even at night, he had a little gas lantern to see the way. He joined the Allegheny Cyclers. That was a local cycling club, about 30 members. Dabbled in racing. So that was sort of his background, really. That's what, I should mention, I think his home wasn't particularly happy. I think he had a strained relationship with his stepfather, and that might have been part of his motivation to get out of the house and get out into nature.
It just, when you see pictures of people riding these bikes, it's kind of mind-boggling. I can't really quite imagine what it would be like, but people raced them and they toured on them. They rode long distances. And in fact, a man named Thomas Stevens had actually ridden around the world, and he did it on a high-wheeler bike.
That's right. And Stevens was Lenz's idol. I'm certain that Lenz would have seen Stevens' bicycle on display. Lenz competed in the fall of 1888 in an unprecedented road race on one of these high-wheelers going from Erie to Buffalo, so that's 100 miles, and it turned out to be just an awful day, so a torrential downfall. So he's not only riding this thing, he's riding it through the mud. And when he got to Buffalo, it's a race he should have won. He finished third, but this was all done in conjunction with an industrial fair, and something like 20,000 fans were gathered in a track to cheer the winners. And Frank saw Stevens' bicycle at that point, because Stevens had returned a couple years earlier, and I'm sure Frank had read all the accounts in Outing magazine that Stevens had sent. So that seems to have kind of planted the idea in Lenz's head to go that he wanted to go around the world. And she said I think part of it was a desire to kind of, top Stevens, outdo him. To instead of doing 14,000 or 15,000, he was going to do 20,000, and he was going to do it in 2 years, not three. So and then his discovery of photography about a year later, that seems to have transitioned him from a racer into a bicycle tourist.
You know, if you go back and you look at the history of the bicycle and you look at very, very early bicycles, things that we would recognize as bicycle, they, in essence, they look like a contemporary bicycle. In some cases, the wheels are not the same size, but they're not like the high wheel bikes that really predominated for a long time. And one has to wonder why they hit on that design, which would seem to be so, let's say, impractical, difficult to ride, and clearly it could be very dangerous to ride.
Right. Well, it is an interesting history that I recount in my first book. And actually, the very first bicycles introduced just about the time Lenz was born in 1867 resembled to some extent, at least in profile, to what we'd call a modern bicycle. That is, they had relatively small wheels, made out of wood in this case, but, a reasonably inviting profile, and that really sparked a great deal of public interest, because it was imagined that this could evolve into the people's nag, so to speak. And then what happened, though, was it took a different course, because development of the high wheeler basically took place in the 1870s in England, and it kind of ceased to be have any practical pretensions, and it became a kind of recreational vehicle for daring young men like Lance. But that high wheel was actually very effective for the roads at the time, which were virtually non-existent, because it absorbed road shock quite well. So, you know, you had a period where Lenz enters the sport, where it's absolutely, you know, almost completely dominated by young men his age. You know, there's a few women tricyclists around, but basically that's what cycling is. And then you have the introduction of the safety bicycle, which kind of ironically sort of revived that original profile. But the big difference was that you had chains. You had the introduction, instead of a direct drive that you had in the first bone shakers and high wheeler, you had a chain and sprocket propelling it. That's a rear drive, not a front. And that meant that you could have that inviting profile and still get the kind of gear that you would want. So that kind of eliminated one of the primary reasons for the high wheeler. And, of course, it was, as built, much safer. So Lenz gets into the sport at a time when it's transitioning. And ironically, he's actually one of the holdouts. He really doesn't want to give up his high wheeler. He resists the safety, like a lot of people his age. You know, they look down on it, literally. I mean, to them, it wasn't a serious bicycle, and they doubted that it could compete with the simplicity and elegance of a high wheeler. But with the introduction of pneumatic tires in around 1891, 92, then it became clear that the safety actually was the faster bike. And that was really the end of the high wheel era.
Yeah, I guess some of the people who rode high wheelers, they were so down on the safety bike that they just quit riding.
That's absolutely true. And Lenz might well have been one of those people. I think he loves cycling too much perhaps to do that. But I'm sure it pained him. I mean, I'm sure he would have done the trip on the high wheeler just as Stevens had done. But by the time he got a sponsor lined up in 1892, the high wheeler was obsolete, and Lenz was realistic enough to appreciate that no one was going to fund him to go around the world on a high wheeler. So he became kind of this pioneer ushering in the great bicycle boom.
Our guest this morning, David Herlihy. He is a bicycle historian. His book, Bicycle, the History, won the 2004 Award for Excellence in the History of Science, and he is a leading authority in the field. He's done a lot of interviews, a lot of speaking on the subject. And his new book is The Lost Cyclist. The subtitle is The Epic Tale of an American Adventurer and His Mysterious Disappearance, and it tells the story of Frank Lenz, a man who set out to ride around the world alone, on the safety bicycle, the kind of bike, if you'd see photographs of it, you'd say, yes, I'd recognize what that is. It has the chain drive. It has pneumatic tires. It has the kind of brakes that we associate with the bike today. And he decided that would be the way he could make his fame and fortune. He set out from Pittsburgh, where he lived. He rode west across the United States. Then he sailed to Hawaii, then to Japan, rode across East Asia, and disappeared in Turkey. The story is told, and there's some really fascinating photographs as well in this book, The Lost Cyclist, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt, if you'd like to take a look at it. Questions welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455, email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, we talked a little bit about Thomas Stevens. This was the man who rode around the world on a high wheeler, more than 13,000 miles. Also before Lenz, there were two guys, Lewis Sockleben and his partner, Tom Gaskell Allen. The two of them rode on safety bikes, although their bikes apparently had hard tires. They did the round the world ride. They rode from London across Europe and Asia to China. They actually rode their bikes across the Gobi Desert.
That's true. They're sort of an interesting contrast with Lenz, because Allen and Sockleben were both college educated, so they were sort of a higher social status there. They were not high wheel riders. When they were seniors at Washington College in St. Louis, That's when the safety, in 1890, the safety bicycle started to come into fashion, and that's when a lot of people had previously foregone cycling took it up. And, you know, they had the means, unlike Lenz, who had to kind of do some campaigning to get a sponsor. They had the means, independent means, to kind of go off on a whim. Wasn't really their plan when they sailed to Liverpool and right after graduation, the summer of 1890, to cycle around the world. They were going to get safety bikes. They knew that. But the idea evolved, shall we say. But Lenz would not have known about them, I don't think, at the time, because they originated their trip in Britain, and they really only gained fame in this country when they came back, which was in early 93, where they arrived on the West Coast, and all they had to do was cross the United States to do their around-the-world tour. And they actually almost, by that time, you know, Lenz had left Pittsburgh in May of 92, and they almost connected in Shanghai. They were going opposite directions, and they missed each other by a few days. And Allen and Sacklevin, in fact, had gotten wind of this other round-the-world cyclist coming through, and they stuck around Shanghai hoping to meet him. But when he was delayed, they decided that they had to move on. So mm-hmm. I don't think Sacklevin ever actually met Lenz.
One of the parts of this that I think is really fascinating is this whole, when you look at this history, how it is the bicycle developed and how people felt about the different kinds of bikes and about how some people were very attached to the high wheel bike and how you certainly had to be young and athletic and most of the people who rode them were men and that they thought that the safety bike was just not serious. I was really tickled, though, by the story that apparently when Lenz got his first safety bike, he almost had a really terrible accident with it. And for him to go from the high wheel to the safety bike, for him, apparently, that took some getting used to.
That's true. It was, absolutely. Very different position on the bike. And, you know, I mean, that was kind of, when you rode a high wheeler, you were sort of on a par with the horseman, which was, of course, the other way to get around in those days before the automobile. So to some people, high wheel fanatics, it was sort of undignified, the idea that you would be that low on your bicycle. And I think the handling was quite different. So, yeah, I think it did take a little getting used to.
And the high wheel bikes had hard tires, and I wonder whether for some of the early cyclists the idea of the pneumatic tire was a hard sell.
Oh, absolutely, it was. In fact, that was one of the daring aspects of Lenz's trip, because although he was compelled to ride a safety, probably the natural choice of tires would have been what they call cushion tires at that point. So that was kind of a bridge between the original hard tire and the inflatable tire, and basically that was just kind of a shell or tube, squishy kind of tire that gave you at least some degree of comfort, and of course it was puncture proof, so that would have been the safe choice. But Lenz, who was very inventive, he did things like he invented his own umbrella for riding, and was also devised various ingenious ways to take his photographs. He tested the pneumatic tire and decided that would be the tire of the future. And at least one reporter thought he was nuts because, he's thinking, if this guy gets flats in India, how on earth is he going to get inner tubes? But what Lenz did was he had a trunk that he shipped ahead of himself, so he carried spare parts in that. And as it turned out, the tires held out pretty well. I think when he did his first leg of the trip crossing the United States, 5,000 miles, I think he had something like 4 flats. So he was quite pleased at the performance of those tires.
Yeah, given how rugged the territory that he covered, and he did some things like going along rail lines, that seems to me amazing that just for that he could ride all the way across the United States and do that and basically only get 4 flat tires.
That's true. Yeah, well, he was correct. I mean, he made a good call on that. It was risky, but you know, he was absolutely right that the pneumatic tire was practical and would be the tire of the future. Mm.
We have a caller. Let's talk with them here on our line number two, someone in Champaign. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Interesting. Comment on the bike prices, the cost, and brakes. Were they metal on metal? Some still have that. And the number of gears. And what about lights for night riding? And clarify when vulcanizing started. That is when they could actually use air tires. Thanks.
Okay. Well, how much did his bicycle cost?
The Victor safety bicycle that he ordered for his trip, I believe, would have cost pretty much, probably about as much as his high wheeler, not a little more, something like $125 or $150, which was, you know, certainly a lot of money. And as far as equipment, Lenz, I don't believe he used a light. But he didn't intend to bicycle at night on his world tour. Let's see, what was the other question?
I know that this bike, this was what we would call a one-speed bike, so there weren't gears.
Well, actually, there was. What he did have was two sprockets in the rear.
Oh, okay, so he had two speeds.
He could flip his rear wheel around. Uh-huh. Get a lower gear when he climbed hills.
Okay. And brakes, what were they like?
Brakes, I believe, were, I'm pretty sure they were the what we'd call the spoon brakes. So they were, in fact, I think he only had one, and that was on the rear wheel. So what that would be is a kind of metal spoon that squeezes down on the tire.
Mm-hmm.
It would have a little leather surface, so it would be the leather on the tire, you know. So that was the best he had for brakes. as far as the vulcanizing process, I think that was part of this whole development of the pneumatic tire. So the pneumatic was pioneered in was actually John Dunlop in Belfast, Ireland, around 1888, I believe, and they start to appear. They were tested in Europe by the late 1880s, and I think the first exhibition of pneumatic tires in this country took place in Niagara Falls in August of 1891, and Lenz was actually there. He had biked with his buddy Petticord. And watched as some unknown racer kind of blew past the competitors using this pneumatic and these pneumatic tires, and there were howls of protest that this wasn't fair.
Mm.
So that, you know, at that point, in 1892 when he leaves, so the next year it's still quite a novelty. But you know, within that year it became the norm, just like the high wheeler had been rendered obsolete. The hard tire safety was quickly rendered obsolete as well.
And this was Lenz had certainly had some experience taking long rides on high wheelers. Mm-hmm. He apparently rode from his home in Pittsburgh. He rode to New York. He also rode from Pittsburgh to New Orleans.
Right.
He took some long rides.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. After you know that race in 1888 and that is in Buffalo, and he got kind of this idea going of going around the world. He started to, what he would do was to plan long distance trips and during his summer vacation with his buddy Charles Petticord. And, you know, this was all part of his campaign to, you know, convince an editor at some point to send him around the world. So the first long trip he took with his buddy, whom I believe he wanted to go with him on that world tour. That was in the summer of 1890. They went from Pittsburgh to St. Louis along the National Road, which is really basically just a dirt road. And so they did that within a month. And then the next year, they planned an even grander trip, and that was Pittsburgh to New Orleans. They first had to go over the Alleghenies. I think they got to Hagerstown, Hagerstown, Maryland, and then down the Shenandoah Valley. They ran into a little trouble. Lenz's, they're still riding high wheelers at this point, and his front wheel collapsed somewhere in Tennessee, I believe. So they had to kind of cheat at the end and take a train through Mississippi, but they did get to New Orleans. And it was shortly after that when Lenz returned, that's when he got his big break. That's when he got the letter from Warman, the editor of Outing, who had also, Outing magazine had also sponsored Stevens. And Warman, you know, had received Lenz's proposal and was quite keen on it, actually. And after interviewing Lenz, decided, you know, set certain conditions, but then he agreed to fund that trip.
Yeah. I'm just intrigued that he passed through sort of our neighborhood on some of his early trips. In the book, there's a picture of him, Lenz, and his buddy Petticord in Collinsville, but you also sent us a photo just when we were making arrangements for the show. You sent us a photo of him, I think it was Lenz and Petticord in Effingham, standing there on the main street of town with their high-wheel bikes.
Yep. Yeah, well, that was that trip that they took in the summer of 1890 to St. Louis. They were trying to get to a grand bicycle tournament, which they just barely made. Got there in the nick of time because the going was very slow. The rain had kind of washed out the national road, rendered it into basically a mud bath. But they did get there, and Lenz got his photos, and he wowed the locals. They couldn't believe, I mean, here he was keeping up, you know, on this fully loaded high-wheeler. He was keeping up with all the scorchers, or the, you know, the top riders and from St. Louis, so that they were surprised that an Easterner could be that tough.
Yeah. He was sponsored on the ride by this magazine, Outing magazine. They agreed to pay him some money and also to insure his life, with the payment to go, if something happened to him, to go to his mother. She was very much against the trip. I think his employer didn't really think it was such a great idea. Here was a guy, you know, young guy, healthy, had a pretty good job. Taking what some people, and his mother certainly thought so, was a crazy risk to do that. Just, was it really as dangerous as you would think on the face of it? The idea, yes, that you were going to set off alone on a bicycle and ride across the territory that he was talking about going across?
Oh, I definitely think it was. You know, even in his first leg, so he decided, for reasons that he never fully explained, he decided to go east to west, unlike Stevens and Allen and Socklebin. So he crosses the United States first alone, but even that was at times dangerous. I mean, wherever he went, he would be received by large crowds and greeted by wheelmen, but there were still some stretches where he was all alone, you know, in the far west. And sure, I mean, he even admitted himself that he almost drowned trying to cross the Yellowstone River, so even that part was dangerous, even in the United States. And you can imagine once he got to China, where the locals were often quite hostile. Yes, that was extremely dangerous. And Socklebin, the fellow who ultimately goes in search of Lenz in Turkey, marveled that Lenz had even gotten that far, you know, because he of course, had gone with his buddy Thomas Allen, and he remarked that, you know, even they had barely survived, but he attributed to the fact that they were two, so that one could watch the other's back. So, yeah, it was very, very dangerous undertaking. And, in fact, I think Lenz really originally, you know, he was not intending to go alone. I think he wanted Petticord to go with him, but for personal reasons, Petticord eventually declined. And then Lenz tried to enlist another buddy who had a hard time deciding whether to go with Lenz or go to dental school, and he finally decided he'd go to dental school. So finally Lenz just decided he'd do it on his own. He was a very fearless sort of character, some would say reckless.
Yeah. There is an amazing story. Among the amazing stories, I'm just thinking about this story here. He, relatively early on in the trip, when he was in Wisconsin, and he was crossing a railroad bridge over a ravine, when suddenly a train appears.
That's right, and that happened, I think, a few times. Lenz very calmly grabbed the front wheel in one hand, and with the other hand, he dangled himself and the bicycle off the ledge of the trestle. And he, you know, waited for the train to rumble by. And when it did, once it passed, and he hoisted himself back up and just continued on.
He's hanging on with one hand to a railroad tie, the other hand to the bicycle, and he's dangling underneath the bridge as a train is going over.
Right, and let's not forget, this is a 57-pound bicycle. It's not what we'd buy today, and it's also fully loaded. He has this camera case in his back, and he's got a big wooden box camera, which alone has to weigh 12 pounds at least. Well, he was a sturdy guy. I mean, he was only 5'7", but he was certainly quite muscular, and he put those muscles to good use from time to time, besides his pedaling.
We're a little bit past our midpoint here. We're talking with bicycle historian David Herlihy about his new book, The Lost Cyclist, that does tell the story of Frank Lenz, this man who decided that what he wanted to do was ride around the world on a bicycle all alone. And he did that setting out from Pittsburgh. He rode west across the United States, sailed to Hawaii, then to Japan, then to China, rode across China, Burma, India into Persia, and then disappeared after he had covered something like 15,000 miles in 2 years. It tells also the story of the investigation into what happened to him. Talk a little bit about maybe what some of his experiences were. He was through Japan, and then he rode China, and was in India and Burma. And if people look at the book, they can see some of the photographs of the places where he was. Among other things, there's an amazing photograph of him standing with his bicycle and with the Taj Mahal in the background. That's a pretty amazing photo, and some other things like that. So tell us a little bit about some of his experiences there in East Asia.
Well, you know, he starts out in, after his brief stop in Hawaii, which was very pleasant, he spends a month in Japan, covers about 1,000 miles. You know, that was his first experience abroad, but he found it quite agreeable. Found that overall the Japanese were quite friendly. There was a little bit of culture shock for him. Point he's staying at an inn, and the proprietor asks if he'd like to take a bath. Lenz agrees. He gets on a robe. He heads over to the tub, and to his great shock, there were something like 3 ladies and 2 men already there in the tub. And Lenz says, noted that, after, you know, recovering, he just simply disrobed and headed in as if he'd been doing this all his life. So he was a sort of resourceful type. I mean, he understood that, that he'd have to make, adjust to certain cultures and also diets, of course. He was okay with the Japanese diet. Overall, everything, you know, except for one incident where a chambermaid tried to lift $20 from his wallet, he had a pretty good time in Japan. But all along, he was fearing China. That was really, he knew that would be the toughest part. And Stevens, in fact, had not actually crossed China by bicycle, or just done a very small part of it. So, and of course, he didn't know that Allen and Sokolobin had already crossed China, but over the Gobi Desert, as you point out. His route was different. He was going to go from Shanghai. He was going to follow the telegraph lines to Burma. And the reason for that was, in part, just because they showed the way. And also there were, cities along the way with missionaries, and he preferred to stay with them whenever he could. And there were, of course, telegraph stations along the way. So he often, and they were generally run by foreigners, so he often took refuge there. But crossing China was extremely difficult. And as I recount in the book, one incident where he's nearly killed by a mob that for some reason had turned against him. You know, the fact that he has to cross mountains and it's the winter. I mean, it was just an extremely bold undertaking. And you can see how Lynn's underestimated. In the book, I have a letter he wrote when he's taking the boat over to Japan, and he's writing the brother of his stepfather, and he says that he expects to get through Japan in January and February. Well, you know, the following June, he was still in China, so you can imagine he didn't get through China in 2 months as planned. Mm-hmm. But once he got out of China, you know, and he had an illness at the very end, I think he's had to spend a few weeks at a telegraph station recuperating. But he, you know, he thought the worst was behind him. So, you know, Burma was tough, too, because of the monsoons. And he had wound up taking a boat, which he really didn't want to do, from Rangoon to Calcutta. He wanted to do it overland, but at the last, you know, he finally decided that that would not be practical. And then when he gets to India, he's actually, you know, again quite comfortable, and he's thoroughly convinced that the worst is behind him. The roads are pretty smooth. He's quite friendly with the British colonialists there. You know, he does the Grand Trunk Road. There's bungalows along the way, and he's cycling now as opposed to walking, which he, you know, basically had to cross China by walking. So things were really kind of looking up for him. He takes his final boat ride from Karachi to Bashir, I think. It's a port in Persia now, Iran. And then he begins to go northward, to heading towards Tehran. And he's going to get up to Russia, to the border, and then cross into Turkey, and that's going to be his final leg when he gets to Constantinople, now Istanbul. That's his gateway to Europe, and from then on it would be kind of a picnic because, you know, of course, Europeans were quite friendly and familiar with the bicycle, and he's going to visit some relatives in Germany, and that's going to be the grand finale. But unfortunately, never gets there.
Well, he was sending back accounts of his trip as he was going along, and I'm sure that there was some time delay. At what point did people here back in the United States start to worry that something bad had happened?
Well, the last communication from him was at the end of April 1894, so that's about 2 years into his journey, and of course he's behind schedule here, but so he sends a letter, which I reproduce in the book, or at least the envelope, to his friend Charles Petticord back home. He writes Outing Magazine, sends an account. He says that he's on his way to Constantinople, and it's only about, I think it's about 1,200 miles away, and he can't wait to get there. And he had been advised not to go through Turkey because of the volatile situation and to go through Russia instead, but he wanted the most direct route. You know, so he's sending reports back every month. There's no report in May. Nothing's received in May or June. That's the point where Warman, the editor of Outing, should have been a little worried, but it's not clear. He kind of brushed it off at first. He said, you know, that Lenz would reemerge. I don't know if that was just his posturing or if he really felt that way. But in July of 94, Mrs. Lenz gets a cable from Thomas Cook and Sons of in Constantinople. They're the people who are receiving Lenz's trunk, or they have Lenz's trunk, and they notify her that it's been sitting there for quite some time and nobody's picked it up, and they want to know what to do with it. And of course, that's you know, Mrs. Lenz hasn't heard from her son in some time either, so she's, of course, in a panic mode at that point. And still warm and kind of resists any notion that there's any problem and tries to assure Lenz's family and friends that he'll reemerge. He's just out of communication for a while. And there's a certain amount of stonewalling going on. And, you know, finally Lenz's friends decide that they need to notify the State Department and also organized to send an investigator over there.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus, just to introduce again our guest for anybody who has just tuned in. We're talking with David Herlihy. He's an historian of the history of the bicycle, has written a book on that, Bicycle the History, and also has a new book that tells this story that we're telling here this morning, The Lost Cyclist, about the American adventurer who decided that he was going to ride, Frank Lenz, who decided he was going to ride across the United States and then Asia and then Europe and ride around the world alone on a bicycle. The story is told in The Lost Cyclist, and it's a good story. And there are a lot of really nice photographs in there, too. So you'd like to take a look at it. It's out recently, published by Houghton Mifflin Harcourt. And questions welcome, 333-9455. Toll-free 800-222-9455. Email will-talk@illinois.edu. Well, it seems it's sort of natural that when they decided to send somebody, that the man that they would pick was William Sockelman, who was the guy who, along with his buddy, Tom Allen, were the among this handful of men who have actually done this and had ridden through essentially some of this territory, had done what Lenz was attempting to do from the other direction, but essentially had done the same thing. So it seemed that outing, when they were looking for somebody to send to try to figure out what happened, that it seemed natural they would pick him.
Right, except that at first he wasn't Warman's first choice. Warman wanted to send Robert Bruce, who was his former assistant at Outing, who was the editorial assistant who had accompanied Lenz as kind of an advance man for the first portion of the journey, so from New York City, when Lenz went through, you know, to the Outing headquarters, all the way to Minneapolis. But it was really Lenz's Pittsburgh friends that, you know, they wanted Sockelman. They thought he was an older fellow, had been in Turkey. And Warman ultimately decides to kind of dump Bruce, and so as not to have two investigations going on. He was terrified of that. It seems to have been something of a control freak. He was quite worried about information leaks and that sort of thing. So he decided to hire Sockelman, and that's how he got the job. So he did go over. There were numerous delays while all this was kind of playing out, and then you had weather-related delays because Warman didn't want to send Sockelman over in the dead of winter to Turkey. So finally, Sockelman gets to the general area where Lenz was last seen about a year after he was thought to have been killed or kidnapped. So there was unfortunately quite a delay in getting the investigation going.
Mm-hmm. Just a little bit more about this man. He talked earlier about how at least Lenz and his buddy had ridden through central Illinois. Sockelman is actually from Illinois. He grew up in Alton.
That's absolutely right. Yeah, he did. And he was quite a celebrity there, naturally. He returned in the fall of 93, and that was about a year later is when his name started to surface as someone who really should go find Lenz. And that suited him just fine, because although he was doing quite well, he had opened a bike store in downtown St. Louis. He was just one of these adventurous sorts. He really thrived on, kind of like Lenz, I think. They were kindred souls in some ways. And so the prospect of going to Turkey, even though the Ottoman Empire was kind of collapsing and there were reports of massacres of Armenians, that didn't daunt Sockelman. In fact, I think he found that all quite enticing. So he was quite eager to go over there. And, I'm sure he did hope to find Lenz's remains. So I think there was genuine humanitarian goals as well. He met Mrs. Lenz on his way to Turkey, stopped in Pittsburgh, and consulted with her. And, he was very pessimistic. He knew he wasn't going to find Lenz alive, but he very much hoped to find Lenz's remains and, was prepared to sort of symbolically finish the bicycle ride as well. Yeah. So he wanted to bring her some consolation, some closure, as we'd say today.
So in short, here again, we have maybe about 5-6 minutes. What did he find?
Well, he did find, it appears, bits and pieces in a certain town in Turkey, bits and pieces of Lenz's camera surfaced. And he believed, he thought he found, had found the murderer, a Kurd, who was allegedly had, well, in fact, I think the Kurd admitted that he had an inner tube, you know, which obviously belonged to Lenz. There wasn't any question about that. But according to the Kurd, he had, his son had found it along this riverbed. And in fact, there were other bits and pieces in the hands of local Armenians. So the evidence certainly points to an ambush outside this town, Chilkani, it's called. But what isn't clear is, was Lenz in fact killed at that spot? Because his body wasn't found, the bicycle wasn't found. There were reports of him being, the initial reports all had him being killed some 30 miles further west in the hills, as opposed to the plain where this town was. So, you know, unfortunately, it just wasn't, it's all kind of unclear. And given the climate, the late start of the investigation and, you know, the massacres happening nearby, it was, of course, not a, not an easy mystery to unravel. Mm.
And certainly one of the things that resulted was some tension between the governments of Turkey and the United States. And I'm sure that there were a lot of people in the United States that felt that Turkey wasn't being cooperative in providing much assistance in this. Would you say that was correct?
No, the Turks really denied. The first response was simply to deny that Lenz had ever gotten into Turkey. You know, they certainly didn't want any part of this. There were, you know, the whole country was in chaos, and the last thing they needed was some kind of PR disaster. So they really didn't, you know, they were hoping to basically just deny any responsibility. And Sokolobin was quite frustrated by all this and trying to push our minister, Alexander Terrell, who was this kind of aging Texan who got this job in Constantinople and who had very little sympathy for Lenz and kind of fancied himself as a diplomat with you know, certain influence, personal influence with the Sultan. And in fact, it turns out he really didn't have much clout. it dragged on. I mean, the Turkish government offered very little support. Finally, an arrangement was made whereby an Ottoman official who was in charge with implementing certain reforms in the region, investigating the massacres, agreed to take Sokolobin along to the area to help him make arrests if necessary. So, but at one point, our minister actually met with Abdulhamid II and to discuss the Lenz case. And in fact, this was closely followed by the American press. And Terrell, you know, told the Sultan quite frankly that, you know, 60 million Americans are watching this case, and you know, they're not satisfied, and that the Turkish government has done everything possible, and that got Abdulhamid in kind of defensive mode, but it seems to have helped somewhat in advancing the case. And there were arrests eventually made, but mostly Armenians were probably innocent. So no, overall, I'm afraid there was. It was just kind of a miscarriage of justice, to say the least.
Yeah. Eventually, the Turkish government did pay some money, not a lot of money, but did make a payment to Lenz's mother.
Well, that's true, but not directly. I mean, she wanted, I think originally she asked for $40,000 indemnity based on the fact that she was reliant on her son's income, and she charged that the Turkish government had failed to give him adequate protection. It's kind of unclear whether she claimed that her son had asked for the Zaptio, which is kind of the horsemen guards that escorted Alan and Soklobin, and that he had been denied. It's not clear to me whether that's actually the case. I mean, Lenz was certainly kind of a reckless sort who might well have decided to go ahead alone. But in any event, what happened was there were so many complaints and claims against the Turkish government by American citizens that it was all kind of the Sultan agreed to pay a lump sum, you know, without admitting any culpability.
Mm.
So the State Department accepted this lump sum, and it was all kind of he was also having a warship built in Philadelphia, so he basically kind of added an extra payment, and then the State Department dispersed the funds. And I think Mrs. Lenz wound up with about $3,000, which, you know, was still a certain sizable amount, you know, and I'm sure she needed it.
We almost have about a minute, maybe a little bit less. Why do you think that these men who that we've talked about that made these trips so captivated the imagination of people, I think really all around the world?
I think it starts with the bicycle. I mean, shortly after they returned, you have the great bicycle boom. So they were definitely pioneers. I mean, there was a growing fascination with this vehicle, and they were certainly proving its utility. And they just they fell into that kind of general category of adventurers and explorers, you know, people, you know, the kind of the round the world, the African explorer genre. I mean, there were some similarities. I mean, they're braving the elements. They weren't really making scientific discoveries per se, but they were that mold. I mean, that was that kind of, you know, resourceful adventurer, daredevils, if you will, and that certainly had a lot of appeal.
Well, there we're going to have to leave it. It's a great story, and if you want to read it, to look for the book that we've talked about, The Lost Cyclist, by our guest David Herlihy. He is also the author of Bicycle, the History, won the 2004 Award for Excellence in the History of Science. And Mr. Herlihy, thanks very much for talking with us today.
Oh, my pleasure. Thank you.
And you've been listening to a program from the Focus Archive. The show was first broadcast on June 9th. Many past programs from Focus are there on the archive. You can listen anytime that you're ready. Just go to will.illinois.edu, and we will reschedule the program that we were going to do this morning. We had planned to talk with Dr. John Wang, a neurosurgeon at Carle Foundation Hospital Stroke Center, about stroke, its diagnosis and treatment. And he had to take an emergency case and couldn't be with us, but on another day, we'll have him here and we'll have that conversation.
Support comes from the Prairie Ensemble, which opens its new season with A Taste at Tiernan's, an old opera house in downtown Urbana, on Tuesday, November 16th. Light snacks and a tasting of German wine and beer will accompany Beethoven's Septet in E-flat. Details are available at 355-9077 or prairieensemble.org. Support for today's broadcast comes from Subaru of Champaign County, now on Route 45 in Savoy. At Subaru's assembly plant in Lafayette, Indiana, a zero landfill status is designed to save cost and our future. It's part of what makes a Subaru a Subaru. Information online at subaruofchampaign.com or 352-4700.
And that's Focus for today. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine with Celeste Quinn.
Thank you, David. This is Illinois Public Media, WILL 580 AM and 90.9 FM HD3 Urbana. You'll find us online at will.illinois.edu. It's 1 minute before noon. In Kansas City, December wheat trading at 7.49¾, down 4½. March, 7.65¾, down 4¼. December wheat in Chicago, 6.97½, down 5. March, 7.37¾, down 4¾. December corn, 5.76½, down 3/4. March, 5.90, down 1/2. May, 5.96¼, unchanged. July, 5.99¼, up 1/2. November beans, 1224.5, down 3/4. January, 1235, unchanged. March, 1241.25, up 1.25. May, 1242.25, up 2.25. July, 1246.75, up 2. December meal, 336.80, down $1. December oil, 49.75, unchanged. December live cattle, 98.50, up 35. February, 101.65, down 12.5. November feeder cattle, 111.02.5, that's up 67.5. January, 111.65, up 105. December lean hogs, 66.15.